is John Lobel. You can hear my show Visionaries at 10 a.m. on Mondays on PRN. And guess what? PRN now has its own app. So you've always been able to listen to our shows by going to your web browser and putting in PRN.fm. And then you can listen to the current show that's on air. But you can now download onto your smartphone, Android and iPhone, our PRN browser. Search for it in your app store, and you can listen live to whatever's on at the moment. So download now our PRN.fm app.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotopia, Solotopia,
so these are
Solotopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple.
Why?
The garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh, yeah.
Don't you know
started to burn too many things we found. That's the magnificent Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger of great, great, great fame and legend, along with David Burns, who wrote the song, except for the word Solartopia, which I did. I'm Harvey Sluggo Wasserman, back with you for another hour at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show here at PRN. Thank you, crew in New York, and thank you, Arnie Gunderson. Are you on with us, Arnie?
Yeah, hi, Harvey.
Arnie, it's great to talk with you. Kate Brown, you with us?
I'm here.
Hey, we got a full house. Fantastic. And unfortunately, we are talking on the day before the anniversary of the Chernobyl catastrophe, just after the 39th Earth Day? It's the 49th Earth Day, amazingly enough. So next year will be 50 years of Earth Day, dating back to 1970. And look what it got us, a mad, satanic Earth destroyer in the White House and a nuclear power industry completely out of control. But we're doing our best, and we're bringing it around. I got to say that I am proud to be with Arnie Gunderson, one of the great heroes of saving the Earth, the one guy that you could go to during the Fukushima disaster and find out what was really going on. Arnie Gunderson, you were the only go-to source for reliable information on Fukushima as it was happening. You did an incredible service, and unfortunately, you weren't available for that role during Fukushima. I'm sorry, during Chernobyl. And we needed somebody. But, you know, it's pretty inevitable that another one of these is going to happen, God forbid. So let's talk about it. Arnie Gunderson, you're in South Carolina. Kate, where are you, Kate Brown?
I'm in Pasadena, California.
Oh, okay. Well, you're around the corner from me. I'm in Valley Village. But we are spanning the continent here. And what we want to talk about is this insane bailout going on, wave of bailouts, scourge, tsunami of bailouts going on for the old nuclear plants. They're trying to do it in Ohio now at the same time that the Fukushima disaster is still pouring radiation into the Pacific Ocean is so far from being solved. So, Kate, let's start with you and then Arnie. You have a book that was just reviewed in the New York Times about Chernobyl, and then we'll talk with Arnie more about Chernobyl and about Fukushima. So tell us, Kate Brown, about your Chernobyl book and what led you to do it and what your conclusions are.
Well, my Chernobyl book is called A Manual for Survival, A Chernobyl Guide to the Future, and it came out about a month ago with Norton. And I worked my way, I'm an historian at MIT in the Science, Technology, and Society Department, and I worked my way through 27 archives on this book. And I was interested in trying to figure out, you know, simple things like what's the death count, how many people were hospitalized, what kind of environmental and medical damage did the accident cause. And what I found as I worked my way through archives, and I was one of the first persons to check out files from the Ministry of Health archive in Ukraine, and I found that most of what we know about Chernobyl is incorrect or incomplete. For instance, take the number of people hospitalized after the accident. Moscow said, you know, 300 people were hospitalized. I found that was only 300 people in one hospital. If you look at all the hospitals in the Soviet Union, in the western half after the accident that summer, 40,000 people, not 300, but 40,000 people were hospitalized with because of Chernobyl exposures. A quarter of them were children. So these weren't just firemen and nuclear operators, people paid to take risks, but civilians, pregnant women, children, all kinds of people. Take Moscow said, you know, we've safely contained radioactivity inside the Chernobyl zone, which was a 30-kilometer circle around the plant drawn in the days after the accident and depopulated. What I found is that right after the accident, pilots went up from Moscow. They manipulated the weather over rural Belarus to make radioactive fallout land on rural Belarus in order to save the big Russian cities, including Moscow, because a big storm was building up heading their way. Simple question of death counts. UN sites say that 33 to 54 people died from the accident. In Ukraine, the Ukrainian government alone gives 35,000 people whose spouses have died with a Chernobyl-related illness compensation. That's just people old enough to marry. That doesn't include children and people who never married. The bigger count that Ukraine has is 150,000. Now, that's just in Ukraine alone. Ukraine got the least amount of radioactivity. Belarus and Russia received far more Chernobyl radioactivity. They don't have a count. Nobody there are courageous enough to take that count.
Oh, my God. Well, of course, the biggest number, and then we'll get to Tony in a minute here, the biggest number was the 985,000 in the book compiled by the three Russian scientists, whose names were, there were two, I think two of them were brothers. Arnie, do you remember the name of the three?
Yeah, Nesterenkov and Alexei Yablokov.
Yablokov, yes. And that was quite a while ago that they estimated 985,000 deaths. So, Kate Brown, did you look at that archive?
Well, what they do is they draw on research done by Soviet researchers and post-Soviet scientists in Ukraine and Belarus and Russia. And I'm not sure how they got that number, whether that's an estimated projected number. And it's really hard to say, but if Ukraine is counting 175,000 people already dead, and Ukraine received about 30% of Chernobyl contaminants, then I don't see that that number is far off.
Yeah. Okay, Arnie Gunderson, what do you think? What's the death toll at Chernobyl?
You know, first off, Kate's book is incredible. And second off, I was on the other side of the argument during TMI and Chernobyl. You know, I was an executive in the nuclear industry telling everybody not to worry. Don't worry, be happy. And when I saw Fukushima happening and I was no longer in the industry, I said, oh, my God, it's the same playbook. You were talking about how you needed somebody on Chernobyl. I became friends with Alexei Yablokov before he died, and we talked extensively about his book that was translated into English by Jeanette Sherman, and Jeanette did a hell of a job too. In addition to the three scientists who compiled it, you know, there's a problem in that a lot of the data. Is viewed by American scientists as anecdotal poor scientific methods and things like that. But, Yablokov was Boris Yeltsin's science advisor when the Soviet Union dissolved and Yeltsin ran Russia. So, I mean, he's a smart guy. And he was absolutely convinced that that 900,000 number was probably low. But again, it's not the type of work that Kate did in her book. Some of it is extrapolations from other data. You know, whatever the number is, it's got you know, 5 or 6 zeros behind it, which is a lot more than the 50 or so that the nuclear industry will claim died.
Yes, it's staggering that these people can say this stuff with a straight face. I mean, let's jump back one nuclear disaster to Three Mile Island. We still have our people, the industry, claiming that nobody died at Three Mile Island. It's like a mantra. But I actually went to Central Pennsylvania in 1980. And as far as I know, I was the only reporter, along with Anna Mayo of the Village Voice, who actually went there. And because I got some phone calls from people telling me that people were dying, specifically a woman named Jane Lee, who lived within eyesight of Three Mile Island on a farm. I stayed at her house, and you could see the plants from her house. And she called me in the winter of 79-80, and said, because I was known in the anti-nuclear movement, and she said, you know, you got to come here. And she and Joan Osborne, her neighbor, who's still alive, actually, mapped out a township in Lower Swatara and 550 or so houses. And they went door to door and asked people if they had cancer and other radiation-related diseases. And they had a staggering death toll in this one little community near Three Mile Island. And I spent a week or 10 days in people's kitchens and living rooms and barns, you know, and interviewing people. And it was like being in a scientific, you know, a bad science fiction movie. You know, it was horrifying. And while I was there, they vented krypton gas from the core, because of course the core had melted and was still, they were denying that there was a meltdown, but there was still problems. And the local newspaper ran a picture of a cartoon of Superman falling out of the sky because of the krypton gas. But you know, I can guarantee you 100% that people died at Three Mile Island. And you'll both understand this, of course. The other part of the mantra at Three Mile Island was that the radiation was so slight that it was the equivalent of a chest x-ray, single chest x-ray for everybody in the region. Well, if everybody in the region got a single chest x-ray, that included all the pregnant women. And we don't x-ray pregnant women anymore. And because there are known health effects from a single x-ray to a pregnant woman. But nobody ever made that a connection. And then a team of reporters came in from the Baltimore News American. There were three reporters, and the Baltimore News American no longer exists. But their job was specifically to look at the impacts on the animals in the area, because there were a lot of reports of problems with animals. And I will tell you, Arnie and Kate, that I stood across the river from TMI. I mean, it was more than an eyesight. I mean, it was just right there. It was large, and I held a black Cocker Spaniel that had been born right after the accident with no eyes. I mean, that was really freaky. So I wrote it up, and it turned into a book, Killing Our Own, where we looked at all the other instances we could find of human beings being exposed to radiation, the radium dial painters, the atomic veterans downwind from the tests, the people at Rocky Flats, the X-ray industry, actually. A woman, Eleanor Walters, wrote that chapter. I did it with Norman Solomon and Bob Alvarez. And I want to express my condolences to Bob Alvarez. His wife, Kitty Tucker, who was a great actress, just passed away. And, you know, it was devastating stuff. And the book was published in 1982. And, oh, you'll like this. I got on the Today Show with Brian Gumbel. The book was published by Dell. And they put me on a tour. And I sat there. Before the interview, Brian Gumbel and I were just talking about sports. And it was specifically Dr. J, who was the great basketball player at the time. And then the cameras turned on, and I had a four-minute interview with Brian Gumbel. And in the interview, I said that people were killed at Three Mile Island. And that was what prompted the writing of Killing Our Own. And he had no idea that what I had just said was incredibly controversial. And the next day, the industry sent a two-page telegram to NBC News protesting and claiming that Brian Gumbel was anti-nuclear. He knew nothing about the accident. He knew nothing about the industry or the controversy. So, you know, that went along. And then, of course, four years later, after the book came out, comes Chernobyl. And now we have these guys, this industry, running around saying, and even people like James Hansen, saying, well, only 31 people died at Chernobyl. And, Kate, I noticed, you know, your book was reviewed in tandem with another book on Chernobyl in the New York Times. And the Times reviewer liked that book better than yours because apparently it sort of soft-pedaled the impacts. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, the reviewer, Robert Kreese, is a former historian of the Brookhaven National Labs. And I'm critical of the Brookhaven National Labs in my book because they were the ones who supervised the medical testing of Marshall Islanders. Marshall Islanders, and a couple of tests were left in place. Scientists from Brookhaven came in. They, you know, ran all the medical stats on these people, observed them, did not treat them, and they created a control group of unexposed Marshall Islanders to compare them. So this secret, you know, medical case control medical study went on for years. And, you know, I'm critical of that kind of treatment of people and the kind of lack of transparency. So I was surprised that the New York Times gave my book and Higginbotham's book to the former historian of the Brookhaven National Labs to review. I don't think it necessarily means that they were willing to give it an impartial reading. And in that same pull-out section of the New York Review of Books, there was an op-ed saying that in order to fight climate change, nuclear is our future.
God. The New York Times has been very pro-nuclear. It's annoying. It's more than annoying. It's dangerous. Now, in the bio of Robert P. Kreese, who reviewed your book in the Times, I list him as the chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Stony Brook. But Stony Brook's right around the corner there from
Brookhaven.
And Brookhaven.
Yeah, it would have been great had they just put that tagline, as well as, you know, in addition to being, you know, he's also the former historian of the Brookhaven National Lab. That would have been great. You know, then readers could judge for themselves, you know, what they think.
Well, Brookhaven is certainly part of the act. I mean, Brookhaven has always been part of the axis of evil. I mean, that's been a really bad place. Is it still operating, Brookhaven, the lab there at Brookhaven?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's still going.
Arnie, have you had any experiences with Brookhaven and those people?
No, you know, there's an excellent book out, leakage at Brookhaven and cancer clusters and things like that. I think it's available now on YouTube or one of the subscription channels. It's called The Atomic States of America. There were leaks at Brookhaven that contaminated the surrounding communities, and there were statistically meaningful cancer clusters. You know, there were three big disasters in my career: TMI and Chernobyl and Fukushima. You might count that as five because there were three meltdowns at Fukushima. But as Kate has said, there's numerous others that are below the threshold of, you know, wiping out a state, and this Brookhaven 1 is one, out by you, Santa Susana is another. The reaction, and this is why I found Kate's book particularly important, is the reaction of the bureaucracy is always to circle the wagon and protect nuclear power as opposed to protect the citizens who who voted the bureaucracy into power. It's convoluted, but my experience that I had a talk with Governor Thornburg. I was a keynote speaker at Penn State a couple of years ago, and so was Governor Thornburg. And afterward, we were talking behind the scenes, and I said, you know, Governor Thornburg, you were lied to by MedEd, the owner of TMI. And then he paused, and he looked at me, and he said, yeah, I was lied to. And I had the same talk with Naoto Kan when he and I were speaking in California and then up and down the East Coast. And Kan said to me, the information I received, this is through a translator, the information I received was neither accurate nor timely. So if the regulator in Japan, METI, M-E-T-I, and TEPCO, the owner, are not telling the top dog in government, this guy was the prime minister, the truth and the timely truth, it's a technology that's run by an orthodoxy, by a priesthood. And if you're not in the orthodoxy, you're not invited to play in the game.
Absolutely. And, of course, the phrase they always use when you, even on John Goffman, who is the great fount of wisdom on the health effects of atomic radiation and was the chief medical officer of the Atomic Energy Commission, the word they always use is discredited. And whenever I hear the word discredited, I want to start punching people, you know. And so here's a sentence, Kate Brown, from the New York Times review of your book, also Adam Higginbottom's book, that this is my reaction, is to want to punch somebody. Brown endorses the work, that's you, Brown endorses the work of anti-nuclear activists like Ernest Sternglass, many of whose claims that radiation causes everything from high infant mortality and crime rates to low SAT scores have been discredited. Well, I could say this is, but our show is replayed on stations that don't allow four-word words. Ernest Sternglass is a very close friend of mine. I mean, I loved Ernest Sternglass. He was a wonderful man and a very serious researcher. And his claim, this one thing they say here, I had the same reaction. Ernie came out and said that the bomb tests in Nevada had led to lower SAT scores among children downwind. And I said, okay, Ernie, that's a little far out. And then in the course of doing Killing Our Own, I interviewed somebody from the Navy. And the Navy was actually the source of that claim. It wasn't Ernie. It was the Navy. Because the Navy was trying to see why so many of the recruits that they were getting were so stupid. And they looked at everything, and they agreed with Ernest Sternglass that the iodine emissions from the bomb test in the 1950s, in Nevada, had the iodine 131 had crossed the placenta and caused thyroid damage to fetuses in utero, and had in fact led to lowering SAT scores. And here, this guy in the New York Times is putting down Ernie Sternglass for making an assertion that was confirmed by the U.S. Navy. Just absolutely, and Ernie faced that all the time. They're a little intimidated by Goffman. But they were always really glad to tear into Ernie Sternglass. So I'm glad in your book that you give him the respect that was due.
Yeah, in some ways I feel like I've become a character in my own book. You know, what I document in my book is that scientists who took a differing view, scientists who said, you know, there actually is a public health crisis going on here. These Ukrainian and Belarusian public health officials are correct. People like Keith Baverstock, that I write about in my book, tried to alert the international community that there was a large thyroid cancer epidemic among children. This epidemic appeared already 3 years after the accident, 1989. And he was maligned. He was slandered. They tried to fire him. They sidelined his career. You know, all kinds of things in order to get him to stop speaking. And when he refused to do that, they tried to just make him go away professionally. And those kinds of things are occurring now. As I'm, you know, there's sort of a gendered attack. You know, she's in over her head. There's a discrediting of the suffering of people. You know, one of the reviewers who's a physicist who says that the Chernobyl zone is thriving, James Smith, he says, you know, she counts all of these, you know, minor medical problems that aren't really, you know, that don't really bother people. But, I mean, I think if a person has a problem with their circulation system, a problem with their digestive tract, with their endocrine system, or neurological problems, that's, you know, sure, they may still be alive, they're not dead, but that's a real problem for them personally. I think to overlook that is somewhat senseless, you know, insensitive and maybe a bit cruel. You know, what we've come to do is to only look at acute effects from radiation that cannot be denied. So acute effects, of course, are the firemen who got acute radiation poisoning and died within a few months. There was no way to say that that was not connected to Chernobyl contaminants. After 10 years, the international community finally admitted, yes, there is an epidemic among children with thyroid cancer who were exposed to Chernobyl contaminants. The fact that they denied and fought Bavarstock and other Ukrainian and Belarusian scientists who were trying to make a case and showing this very clear evidence meant that there were no long-term studies on other effects other than thyroid cancer carried out among the Chernobyl survivors. And that has really major implications for the rest of us in the world. We have this one big lifespan study of Japanese atomic bomb survivors, and that records less than a second of a high-dose blast, you know, one big X-ray. That study does not take into effect the radioactive fallout that landed on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the surrounding areas after the bombings. And that those chronic low doses of radioactivity are that Chernobyl exposed people to are far more likely to be in our future, hopefully, than a nuclear bomb blast. We are probably more likely to be around radioactive sources that leak, whether they be melting glaciers in the Arctic that have stored radioactive cesium from Chernobyl and Fukushima and all the bomb testing, or whether they be we live near a nuclear waste repository or near a reactor that has an accident. So unfortunately now, you know, France has a lot of aging reactors and they've at long last made a plan for a nuclear emergency should it occur. And their plan is do like they did in Chernobyl, leave people who are exposed in place because there was no problem in Chernobyl, only 33 people died. And so I don't think any of us want to be those people exposed to chronic low doses of radioactivity without any kind of study or research that tells us what's going to happen afterwards. And the Chernobyl records show that there was a major public health disaster where people, and I'm talking about, you know, about a million people experienced chronic problems with multiple organs, often at once, autoimmune system disorders, circulation system disorders, GI tract disorders, and problems with fertility and birth defects are the major ones.
God, you know, it's just so.
Harvey, could I chime in here for a minute?
Absolutely. I get speechless. When
you know, I love Kate's comment about it. She feels like she's become a character in the book. The when I started. When I was on CNN during Fukushima, I was almost immediately attacked by Rush Limbaugh personally. He called me out by name, and he said, "Don't trust this guy. Go to the Nuclear Energy Institute website for the truth." And I was saying, "There's a meltdown." And of course, at that point, NEI was saying there was no meltdown. Even just as recently as last year, we discovered that when I was talking about the problems down at San Onofre, the steam generator failures, personnel at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission itself in their home office in Bethesda were attacking me on the internet 7 times. They're paid during company hours, using company computers, sitting at a company desk, attacking public citizens on the internet. So it's an industry that doesn't accept that if you're outside the orthodoxy, you're at all credible. I just published this peer-reviewed paper about hot particles, and one of the comments in the blog sphere was sometimes even poor scientists can get the right answer.
What?
Wow.
What?
This is peer reviewed, damn it. Anyway, I think the problem is that this is a technology born in secrecy. You go back to Fuller's book, The Day We Bombed Utah, and many others, and that need for the orthodoxy to retain the secret has been pervasive and has trickled in, probably avalanche in a more likely word, into the civilian program as well.
It's just outrageous. So, you know, the latest scam is that we're hearing from people whose names I will not mention, clowns running around promoting the industry, saying that nobody is going to be harmed by the radiation of Fukushima. Do you want to? Are you able to like collect yourself and respond to that one, Arne Gundersen?
I think I was. I've said that over 100,000 people will contract cancer, and I base that off of Steve Wing's work on Three Mile Island. Dr. Wing was an epidemiologist at UNC before he passed recently, and he did a landmark study showing that up and down the Susquehanna River Valley, there were excess cancers, double the cancer rate. He was just looking at one type of cancer. And then, of course, I was an expert at the trial and determined that the containment leaked an awful lot of noble gases, maybe not anywhere near as much as of cesium that Chernobyl or Fukushima did, but an enormous amount of noble gases, which is exactly what happened at Fukushima as well. So if I extrapolate Steve Wing's numbers to the amount of noble gases that were released at Fukushima, I come up with 100,000 cancers, and I'm still out there, and of course I'm attacked on it because the industry is, like you said, saying that nobody died. There's a guy, James Conca, C-O-N-C-A, who on the day that Fukushima began to melt down, the March 11th, he happened to be testifying to the Washington State Legislature, and he assured them that the reactors would ride through the storm just fine. And his quote was, "Working in a nuclear power plant is safer than working in Toys R Us." And now he's a columnist on nuclear for Forbes magazine. So it's tough when the orthodoxy has so much money and so much influence with the media to turn the tide. But books like Kate's are great. That's just what we need, are more voices with well-documented studies to say, hey, look, this thing needs to be reevaluated.
I think
the other point in my book is that exactly the kind of point, the general point we're making, is that after the Soviets spent 4 or 5 years denying and censoring the topic of Chernobyl contaminants and what kind of environmental and medical effects they were having, the Soviet Union was falling apart, and the international community came in to manage the disaster. And as they did so, a few key important opinion makers in the UN worked to help the Soviets also minimize the disaster. They lined up right with them. And, you know, I show in my book all the different ways that they did that, using, as what Arnie would say, that the usual playbook. You know, it's well rehearsed. They even translated that playbook into Russian and gave it to the Russians. You know, how do you manage a nuclear disaster? You certainly don't tell people everything's fine and then list all the food they can't eat. You know, that kind of advice was translated into Russian. But what I wondered about is, what was the motivation? Why would the big, you know, UN powers, which are also the big nuclear powers, US, UK, France, China, help the Russians do this? And what I realized is that in the early 1990s, these big nuclear powers were facing, at the end of the Cold War and the declassification of documents, their own billions of dollars in lawsuits from their own production and testing of nuclear weapons. And that, to me, was a, you know, sort of a terrifying realization that in testing nuclear weapons, the Soviet Union and the United States alone issued 500 times more radioactive iodine than Chernobyl did. And that radioactive iodine circulated mostly in the northern hemisphere and came down, especially in humid areas with the rain. And that radioactive iodine, you know, sort of figures into the growing, you know, probably, but we should test and do some studies to find out, grows into the growing cancer rates that we see, you know, from the 1950s marching upwards, especially in the category of thyroid cancer that continues mysteriously to increase each year. Childhood cancers used to be a medical rarity. Now they're unfortunately no longer are. Male sperm counts since 1945 in the Northern Hemisphere have dropped in half. What is causing these problems? I think we should become more curious and ask of our leaders to have some serious look at these, you know, big public health issues that are global.
Yeah, you know, you wonder if our species really is going to make it. I mean, in my mind, having been with this issue since 1973, as far as I'm concerned, the number one threat to the future of the human race is the 440 or so reactors that continue to operate on this planet. I mean, you have these clowns running around saying nuclear power is fighting global warming, and you're running, you know, what's the core temperature of a nuclear reactor, Arnie?
Say again?
What is the core temperature
of
a nuclear reactor?
When everything's working correctly, it's about 550 degrees. When it loses cooling, like at Fukushima, it pretty rapidly increases to 2,500 degrees, at which point the zirconium clad starts to burn, and you know, it could easily exceed 3,000 degrees. I would disagree with you, though, Harvey. I think global warming and global climate change is a bigger problem. But I absolutely agree with you that nukes are not the solution to global climate change.
Right, but is that Fahrenheit or centigrade? You said 550
Fahrenheit.
Fahrenheit. So, but my point, Arnie, is that global warming is being caused by nuclear power plants. You know, there's all this nonsense about how we need to fight global warming with nuclear power plants. It's like saying you got to heat the planet to cool it, because you have 440 or so 500 degree Fahrenheit fires going allegedly under control. But what happens to all the waste heat from those reactors? You know, they're heating the oceans, they're heating the atmosphere. You got these giant campfires all over the globe, and they certainly are not helping us fight global warming, no stretch of the imagination. So the bottom line to me is that all these reactors, they do create some carbon-14. They certainly create carbon in the nuclear fuel cycle, and then they dump waste heat into the atmosphere and into the rivers, lakes, and oceans. I mean, the last thing we need to do to cool the planet is to have 440 nuclear fires going on, for God's sakes. So,
well, a nuclear power plant is the least efficient way of making electricity. And what that means is that the Carnot efficiency, it's a physics term, is the lowest for a nuclear plant. And what that means is that their consumptive use of water is the highest. If you're going to make electricity, the worst way to make electricity, if you're worried about consumptive use of water, is with a nuclear power plant. But the heat into the rivers and streams compared to what we're putting up with the CO2 from other sources, I would say CO2 is worse. But nukes cannot prevent climate change, one, because it's so expensive, and two, because as the water is heating up, you need more water to cool the plant, which becomes a never-ending cycle.
Yeah, it's a nightmare. And one thing I want to ask you, Arnie, while I got you here, I have read that there are people who believe that Fukushima Unit 1 was already in the process of melting down because of the earthquake before the tsunami came there. Now, do you see any evidence of that?
Yeah, I do. There's two pieces of data that lead me to believe that there was the plant was in trouble even before the tsunami took out the emergency generators. Fukushima 1 has something called an isolation condenser. And by the way, Dresden 2 and 3 in right near Chicago have them too. But when the earthquake happened, all three units shut down, and the diesels turned on, and things were relatively normal. It's called a loss of off-site power. But the core in Unit 1 was cooling down a little bit too fast. So because the operator said, we're going to start this thing up tomorrow. We don't want to cool it down too fast. So they turned the isolation condenser off, and they couldn't get it started again. This is all in that first 45 minutes from when the earthquake happened to when the tsunami hit. So that was data point number one. Something happened in the isolation condenser that they couldn't get it started again. And the other piece of that is that radiation readings at the site boundary began to go up significantly before the tsunami hit. So I think the source of that was a problem in Unit 1. I don't know what it was, but again, I don't think the nuclear industry really wants to find out, especially when there's two identical units sitting right next to Chicago.
Right. So if the earthquake itself would have been the source of the initial meltdown at Unit 1, that means that at Fukushima, that means, of course, that nuclear plants in the United States, like at Diablo Canyon, Perry in Ohio, which was hit by an earthquake, North Anna in Virginia, which was hit by an earthquake, Indian Point, which sits on the Ramapo Fault, all these earthquake-vulnerable reactors, we've already had an instance of a nuclear power plant that seems to have succumbed to an earthquake. Is that a reasonable thing to say?
Yeah, I did a paper for Mothers for Peace on Diablo Canyon, and I looked at there was 12 nuclear plants that had real serious earthquakes in the last 10 years. There was 7 at Kashiwazaki Kariwa, which is on the Sea of Japan side of Japan, the 4 at Fukushima Daiichi and North Anna, and they all had significant earthquakes, and in every one of them, the earthquake was less than what the plant was designed for, but the plant shook twice as much as the engineers ever anticipated it would. So my point is that when the big one hits, I'm not at all convinced that Diablo Canyon or an Indian Point or whatever would survive. And I think the data from Fukushima Daiichi Unit 1 prove that.
God, you know, it's terrifying. You know, every day I live in terror. I live in Los Angeles, and Diablo is less than 200 miles upwind. And I've been there. I was arrested there, spent 3 nights in the county jail there, and it's still operating, and it's worse than ever. As you were well aware, the Pacific Gas and Electric recently burned down half of Northern California, killed 80 people, destroyed 12,000 structures. In 2010, they blew up and literally blew up a neighborhood in San Bruno, killed 8 people. In January, February, I think it was February, they just flat out burned down 5 buildings in San Francisco. I mean, this is the Keystone Cops on steroids. And these are the people running the two nuclear plants that could destroy the entire country. I mean, if God forbid there's a blowout at Diablo Canyon, the radiation will go all the way across the U.S., for God's sakes. We're talking with Arne Gundersen, world-renowned nuclear engineer, and Kate Brown, author of a new book on Chernobyl. I've been dealing with this issue since 1973, and I get even more flabbergasted as time goes on. Kate, can you tell us about this thing that they've just put on top of Chernobyl? What is that?
Well, that's a it's a new sarcophagus, or they call it the cover. It was financed by the international community, the Americans and the EU mostly, and cost a lot of money. And it's an elaborate and designed by the French. The French company, corporation, won the contract to build and design and build it, and they did so with Ukrainian labor and French managers. And it's a very beautiful stainless steel cover. You know, it looks like a wing, a silver wing about to take flight. And it was built on railroad tracks so that they could construct it remotely, so they didn't have to have workers right on top of the smoldering, still smoldering, still emitting radioactive aerosols from the burned reactor number 4. But, what was happening is that the company was about to was as usual with many of these contractors, was behind schedule, and the company managers get bonuses for making their deadlines, and so they rushed, pushing together the two ends of the wings over the reactor and putting it in place and saying, "Ta-da! We finished on time. We get our $1 million bonuses." But what wasn't complete was the electrical work, inside. And so they pushed it in place. They took a lot of press photos. Everybody said how beautiful and wonderful this is. We solved Ukraine, poor pathetic Ukraine's problems. But meanwhile, working inside of that now closed installation, right within the old leaking sarcophagus, are these Ukrainian workers, electricians and plumbers, who are finishing up all the work that wasn't done beforehand and was sped up and done, in this dangerous way, so that the French bosses could get their bonuses for completing the work supposedly on time. There hasn't been, nobody is critical of that cover, but I learned these stories as I worked in the city of Slavutich, which is now the city that is built to support nuclear workers who continued to work on the Chernobyl plant after the explosion, after the first city of Pripyat was depopulated.
So it's the new Pripyat. They built a new Pripyat
there? It's the new Pripyat. It's called Slavutich. Yeah, it was the last city, to my knowledge, that was built in the Soviet Union.
God, it just never ends. Arne, you're familiar with, and everybody knows about the leak, the ongoing seepage or leak or whatever you want to call it, of radioactive liquid into the Pacific Ocean at Fukushima. Can you tell us about that, and what is the likely damage to the Pacific Ocean?
It's interesting. The at Chernobyl, there was a meltdown and a melt through, and there's actually photographs that were taken within a year or two of the beginning of the disaster. I don't use accident because accident implies humans somehow just, like a deer runs into the side of your car. It was a disaster, but anyway, so you've got the core sitting in the basement of the Chernobyl reactor, and people actually took pictures of it. At Fukushima, within a year or two of the time the meltdown began. At Fukushima, the three cores melted down and melted through the concrete, melted through the steel, and wound up in the basement of the three different containment buildings. The basements were subject to high radiation, high heat, high pressure, and they leak. So whether or not the nuclear cores melted through the concrete is irrelevant, because the water from the ground is getting in and is in direct contact with the core. So there's a difference. At Chernobyl, the core is essentially dry. At Fukushima, all three cores are wet, and not with man-made water to cool them, but Mother Nature is leaking groundwater into the containments. Well, what goes in must go out. The same cracks that are letting the water in are also letting it out. And something on the order of 200 tons a day. Again, there's not anybody measuring it because it's leaking through the ground, but something on the order of 200 tons of radioactive contaminated water a day are entering the Pacific. So the Pacific's a big place. We're still detecting cesium off the coast of California, 10 becquerels per cubic meter, which is a becquerel is a disintegration per second. So if you think of a little flashlight turning on and off, 10 times a second, there's a disintegration in a cubic meter, about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, throughout the whole Pacific. And this is going to go on for the life of the of cesium, which is essentially 10 half-lives or 300 years. And that's off the coast of California. The Northern Japan Current takes the water up the coast of Japan, across the Aleutian Islands, and down the west coast of the United States, by Canada first, Vancouver, and then Seattle, Portland, and L.A. and San Francisco, before heading further south. And already, taking that circuitous path, we're seeing 10 becquerels per cubic meter of cesium in the ocean, and it's a big ocean. My takeaway on this is that there's 40 nuclear power plants that use the Great Lakes as their cooling source, or that drain into the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes are 30,000 times smaller than the Pacific. If one of these were to happen on the Great Lakes, you would wipe out the cooling water the drinking water to 50 million people, because they could no longer rely on it. So the ramifications of Fukushima to the Pacific are measurable. And personally, I don't eat Pacific fish anymore. That's a personal choice of mine. I'm not relying on my government or any other government to tell me that. But what the nuclear industry's takeaway should be is, my God, if this happened on the Mississippi or the Missouri or the Hudson River, what would be the ramifications for the downstreamers? And that message is not being driven home. May I say one other thing, and I'll get off here?
No, please.
Kate mentioned the contamination of the forests near Fukushima, and how there were forest fires afterward. And now essentially they've revolatilized all of that radiation. I would love to hear her thoughts on that on your show, if you don't mind.
Kate, we got to hustle. Let me make sure everybody knows how to get a hold of you. Kate Brown, the title of your book and how to get it?
Manual for Survival, A Chernobyl Guide to the Future. It's available on Amazon. And I'm a professor at MIT in the Department of Science, Technology, and Society. And so the forest fire,
Wait, Kate, before you go in. Arnie, yeah. Gunderson, how do we get a hold of you?
Arnie, it's Fairwinds, which is a nonprofit 501c3 founded by my wife, Maggie. And she's really the creative influence. So it's Fairwinds, FAIRE.org.
Okay, and you're Arne Gundersen, a great hero to all of us, especially during the Fukushima disaster. Oh, my God, that's the end. I have to have you guys back. Kate Brown, Arne Gundersen, thank you so much. Everybody, stop nuclear power, for God's sakes. And we'll see you next week in Solartopia.
Shone down on the Garden of Eden.